Hey, I'm Varun, CEO and co-founder of ExaFunction that builds the product Codium, which we'll be talking about. And I like my coffee as a latte. I'm pretty basic. I like just a lot of milk in my coffee.
Welcome back to the ML Ops Community Podcast. I am your host, Dimitri Os, and today was a wonderful conversation with Varun all about how he pivoted his company from doing virtualized GPUs into a code pilot that is killing it. He's got over, I think he said, 400,000 users when we talked to him. And we really went deep into what some of the issues were when it comes to scaling, why he chose to pivot the company, and how they built out their whole deep learning stack. And they really optimize from everything from the training to the inference. They built their own models, so it's not running on GPT-4 or GPT-3 or any of that. They made sure that the main product is free. They made sure that they are able to go and bring this tool into customers' own infrastructure, and it only requires one GPU, which for me was mind-blowing. But then also, he talked about how when he was building the tool that was the GPU VM, basically, the virtualization GPU, before they pivoted, how he had to take this long, hard, cold look in the mirror and say, are we making progress? Are we solving a pain that is painful enough for us to scale to 100 million in revenue? They had great revenue, and it's got to be hard to have incredible revenue and say, you know what, we're going to change the whole direction of the company. And it's obviously worked out for them quite well. I'm very happy that he was so transparent about how things were and how that conversation was with himself, basically. And then how he looks at things moving forward and what he wants to focus on and how he evaluates if his product is actually useful, how he evaluates if the large language model that they built is actually useful, how they're monitoring the use of the product. All of this and more in the next 50 minutes. So hopefully you enjoy, and if you can do one thing and one thing only, it would mean the world to me to share this with one friend that you think will find it useful. And without further ado, let's get into the conversation. But before we do, let's hear a word from our sponsors. All right, listeners, I have the pleasure of announcing right now with you that the MLOps community and Quantum Black, the AI branch of McKinsey & Company, have partnered up. And for this special partnership, I brought on Nair Khan. Your official title is partner, but your unofficial title is professional data nerd. Nair, what exactly is Quantum Black?
No, it's a good question. Really, really great to be here. Let me start briefly and say, look, our origins. We started off in Formula One. We realized early on that we could use data and AI in very smart ways off the track to have big impact on track times. And as I know, we took that mentality of using data and AI in very smart ways to help companies and industries on their toughest AI use cases, really using AI to drive impact. And we've done this across a whole myriad of different industries. I've mentioned Formula One and sports, but there's also natural resources, health and life sciences, consumer, and so on and so forth. We are about 2,000 colleagues globally in 40 different countries, and we have a whole host of different types of skills and technologies, data science, data engineering, as you know, but also DevOps, software engineers, product design, SRE, cloud. So we bring and fuse all these different types of talent all together.
I had the pleasure of going and meeting you in person about a year and a half ago. And I went to the Quantum Black office in London. And I loved it there because you set up a nice little Lego welcoming mat for me that said MLOps. And we also had some whiteboarding sessions. And you blew my mind with some of the projects that you are working on internally. Can you tell us a little bit about what makes Quantum Black special and that vibe that I felt when I was there?
So I think, you know, we are part of McKinsey & Company, but one of the things that we've maintained as QB is try to keep our culture. And there's two different things. It's our always learning type of mindset and being very curious about the problem, but also curious about the solution. there's a lot of great technology and solutions out there, but there's also a lot of white space that hasn't been solved. And I think our teams really get down and really are happy trying to drive through solutions with that. The second is this fun aspect. You mentioned Lego, and Lego is part of our DNA and really doing things in new and creative ways. I think this is really, not only with the organizations we work with, is very energizing, but also our people. They really, really dig this way of working.
Incredible. So if anyone wants to go deeper down the rabbit hole and learn more about what you all are doing at Quantum Black, we're going to leave a link in the description. Quantum Black is always on the lookout for incredible talent. So if you think you fit the bill, we'll also leave a link for you to contact them. Thank you, Nair, for coming and joining us. Let's get back to the show. Dude, I know we're here to talk all about what you've been up to and just really get into this idea of a coding pilot and the work you're doing with Codium. And I would love to start, though, I guess, before any of that, and hear about how you got into tech and what gave you the bug.
Yeah, I guess this goes back, this might not be that cool, but this goes back to maybe high school. I did a lot of these programming competitions. This might be a common story with a lot of people. Actually, me and my co-founder used to do programming competitions in high school. He did much more than just the competitions. But because of that, we did programming competitions together. I was really excited about that. Went to MIT. Actually, my co-founder and I were the same year at MIT also. So we did competitions against each other in the Bay Area. And then after that, worked a lot together at MIT. After that, I joined a company called Neuro. They build autonomous goods delivery systems. I worked there for around 4 years, became a sort of a senior manager at the company, overseeing large-scale deep learning workloads. And my co-founder was at Oculus building deep learning compilers at the time. So afterwards, we both came away with a sense of deep learning was going to revolutionize many industries, and we wanted to make technology to make it easier to scale and run these deep learning workloads for these different verticals. That's where we started the company ExaFunction over 2.5 years ago. And what we started, and I think for your audience, this would be maybe a common story. We started with, hey, we think scaling GPU workloads is hard, right? GPUs are not very, very easy to run diverse workloads on for a variety of reasons. GPUs have a limited amount of memory. Models use up a lot of memory in GPUs, so it's hard to run a lot of models at the same time. So we built, in some sense, GPU virtualization technology. So take workloads that would run on GPUs, and instead they would run on CPUs, and transparently under the hood, it would take these anything you could run on GPUs, including CUDA kernels, like the lowest level stuff, and it would offload them to a remote GPU. And if a machine dies, we would actually transparently make it run on a different machine without the user even knowing, by reconstructing the state of what was on one machine or another machine. And so ExaFunction started out doing this, and we sold to a handful of companies. And we sold to many companies, but most of the large workloads were from a handful of companies. And we ended up managing upwards of 10,000 GPUs for a handful of companies. And one interesting stat I like to throw around is, at our peak, we were managing over 20% of GCP's GPU inference capacity in a single region. And we were optimizing these workloads. And you can imagine 2.5 years ago, that was very important because there was a scarcity of GPUs. GPUs were expensive. And there were a lot of these large autonomous vehicle workloads that just required a lot of GPUs. And specifically, the workloads they were running were these simulation workloads. Maybe just to go into that like a little bit, the fundamental reason in these AV workloads where the reason why simulation is so big is it is quite expensive to collect miles in the real world. And it is much cheaper and much more safe to collect it offline. So, but that does require running your entire deep learning stack offline. So we were targeting these large, large workloads. And for us, I guess, interestingly, you know, if you were to think about MLOps, we were targeting the inference space. But the thing that we felt, and this is maybe a little bit of a hot take, was middle of last year, as we started to basically work on generative AI workloads, we used to have companies tell us, hey, can you optimize these transformer workloads for us? We provided them with solutions, and we actually even built our own in-house deep learning compiler that competed against TensorRT, and we actually sold it to large autonomous vehicle companies. And
no
even right now, there are AVs running around with ExaFunctions compiler technology running
on
them. But we realized that transformers in generative AI was going to fundamentally change the ML landscape. We were not going to see nearly as many conventional ML engineers. And maybe if I can go into that a little bit more, instead of having many people in your company tuning these BERT models, for instance, for sentiment classifier, you were going to take these large generative models, and instead you would just ask them, is this a positive or negative sentence? So we fundamentally felt that there was going to be a shift in the set of people that were going to consume ML. It would be normal engineers rather than really, really specialized ML engineers is what we felt was going to happen.
And so you saw that boom coming with the ability to use these large language models instead of having to get really deep in the weeds and be very knowledgeable about ML.
That's exactly right. And I think we were targeting these workloads where people had custom bespoke models, and we were able to multiplex them across many GPUs. But we saw the writing on the wall that it's possible in like a year, no one is going to be training a ResNet model or a tuned ResNet model. What was instead going to happen is there would be a good enough single shot image classifier model, which, to be honest, proved to be the case. But there would be industries where people would need to, where the precision recall matters a ton, like autonomous vehicles. It is not good enough to have 90% precision recall, because if you miss out on the 10%, you could potentially kill someone. But we felt the vast majority of workloads would not look like that. So what we decided was we felt that the workload we were serving was slowly on the, you know, going to decline. And we thought generative AI was going to revolutionize the way we do work, period. And I think we came up with a big shift of, hey, why don't we use our technology to scale and run these models to basically build our own generative AI application, which is probably a very strange sort of transition to do. And we were all early adopters of Copilot at the company. So what we decided was, hey, why don't we think that there's much more to programming than just what Copilot has done? Why don't we start and try to build what Copilot has today? And we believe that there's significantly more, but we added a twist that we forced on ourselves, which is the product had to be entirely free, which forced us to make the infrastructure scalable, which forced us to optimize the infrastructure, which forced us to train our own models. Codeium is not built on top of, which is, I can go into more, it's not built on top of OpenAI. It's not built on top of Anthropic. And that has its own set of advantages that we've been able to make as a company. And it's built on top of a lot of the infrastructure we built 2.5 years ago. So this didn't happen in a vacuum. So middle of last year, we sort of started working on Codeium, and the spelling is Codeium. We started working on Codeium. And one quick question that people ask is, why didn't you guys just build ops for LLMs, right? I guess that's a common question people have asked us, instead of why did you guys pick Codeium? And I think the reason why was we felt that it was generative AI was having its internet era. It was similar to what was going on in the late 1990s. And one thing that I believed is, and this is maybe a stupid take for me, was the biggest companies that I remember from, you know, the late 1990s are the Googles and the Amazons. It's not the people that build web server infrastructure. And it's not because web server infrastructure isn't big. It's just that the space was so new that the companies with the largest workloads or the largest applications ended up building the craziest things for themselves rather than outsourcing the technology, because it was so nascent. It was unclear what you wanted to build for someone, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. It's like you are creating the infrastructure for yourself because you have this lofty goal of an end product that you're going to give to your customers.
Yep, that's exactly right.
So, well, dude, I got to ask, because it feels like we are still in this GPU scarce world, and the idea of ExaFunction and the capabilities that it had. I mean, I know so many people that are banging their heads against the wall today because they get those ohm errors, right?
Ohm errors, yeah. They're out of memory, right?
Yeah, exactly. So You took a hard right or a hard left and said, okay, instead of helping people with these errors and figuring out how to offload some of this stuff and helping them with the lower level CUDA workloads or just lower level CUDA pains that they're going through, you are going to leverage what you've created there and then help them with the coding part, which is very much an end user, almost like you went
B2B. We're now there's like a consumer at the end.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to I'm an infrastructure layer for some really advanced ML/AI company.
Yeah. If I can go into that a little bit, it's that we believed that transformers and generative AI was going to make up a large fraction of GPU workloads in the future. But we felt by only providing value at the inference layer, we were not really helping the end company in the way that I wanted to help them in a differentiated way. So let me maybe go into that a little bit and, you know, feel free to stop me.
Yeah.
In the past, if there were many different model types, yeah, there were many different things to optimize on. But now the set of workloads that were happening, they were sort of narrowing down and homogenizing. Yeah, there are differences in different transformer architectures for sure. Like you can have maybe sparse attention layers. You can have, you know, multi-query attention versus group query attention. And there are different nuances. But for the most part, everything started to zero in on a certain type of architecture. So what I felt was over time, the infra layer maybe will not commoditize, but at the very least, the differentiation was reducing. In addition to that, what I also felt was we were solving a very little amount of the pain of the company. And I'm saying that from the perspective of many generative AI companies or application companies reached out to us to run at the time, a bit over a year ago, the best model that was out there was GPT-J, which is actually like still a really good model, but it's not going to compete with any of the GPT-3 models.
Uh-huh.
And that's fundamentally because for a variety of reasons. A, like, let's say someone like a Jasper reached out to us. Did it have proper data for content marketing? Did they clean the data properly? Did they actually fine-tune the model properly? Like, did they figure out how to train the model properly? Did they figure out how to evaluate the model properly? First of all, evaluation in and of itself, I could talk for an hour about evaluation and how we do evaluations at the company. It's very domain-specific. It has what we do for code evaluation looks nothing at all like what other companies do.
Oh,
by the way,
fascinating.
And then did they actually run the model efficiently? Yeah, that's there's a little bit of that component. And the fifth part, can they A/B test different models in the wild properly? Can they effectively build A/B testing? And then on top of that, can they take user data, whether or not it's exact data, but preference data, to then further improve the model? And as you can notice, each of these pieces are different. And yeah, like you can build a point solution for each one of these, but that's not going to solve the real pain. Like imagine me as an application company buying 6 or 7 point solutions to run my generative AI app. I just felt like that was like going to be weird.
Yeah, that's not the future.
Yeah.
So I 100% see that vision. It's like there, especially the way that you put it, where the pain was a small pain point and there were so many other pains in that journey that you weren't touching. So you were almost dependent on the fact that they needed to get 2, 3, 4 steps right before they even started talking to you and were advanced enough to need your product.
That's actually a great way to put it, especially given the fact that these companies beforehand were running on top of an OpenAI model. And in a lot of the cases, what I told them, and this is because like, serving a customer is great, but being honest with them is what's going to create long-term value. I just said, if you guys don't do the other stuff, it's just better to continue using OpenAI.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's the hard truth right there. Because we can all talk about fine-tuning and how nice it will be when we have our own proprietary model. But then there's the hard parts of actually making that happen. And
exactly
what you need to go through to make that happen is something else. And so you have to become very skilled at it. I mean, granted, I think there's a lot of momentum going in the direction of trying to find ways so that it is not as hard as it probably was like a year and a half ago. But it's definitely not like click a button easy. right? And I don't think we're ever going to get there because you need the data, and the data is the messy part.
That's exactly right. You need the data. You need the infrastructure to build out all the other stuff. And there are still domain-specific problems on a per kind of generative AI app basis. The kind of work that we do to evaluate our product looks different than what our friends at Midjourney do. Yeah. They're doing something a little bit different. The way they look at human, they look at feedback, and the way they constantly improve their models, it looks different. And this is where it comes back to, like, yeah, maybe there was something common that companies could have sold to both Amazon and Google, right, in the early days. But my sense is it was quite hard. It made a lot more sense in the weird way to sell AWS. That was your cloud infra solution in maybe 2006, 2007, once the early ages of the internet had been proven out and there were some winners. But it doesn't make sense to provide technology to companies, in my mind, this is maybe a little bit of a hot take, before there are well-defined workloads in the space already that you can tackle.
I see. So you're basically saying, like, because we're so early still with ML and AI, it's, in your eyes, you didn't want to jump in and be opinionated about something before the cards had fallen.
Yeah. And then I think until then, I believe, and not only maybe this is like, there's a pragmatic way to look at it, and also there's a passion way to look at it. I believe building applications is where the value will actually lie, ultimately. But all that being said, at the same time, like, I also believe what we're doing to accelerate software development with Codeium is fascinating, and I'm super passionate about it and happy to talk about that as well. But yeah.
Yeah, I find that fascinating too, because obviously I play a lot in the ML ops sphere, and these days, as you know, it's hot to call it LLM ops. But the idea of, oh, the real value is at the application layer, I'm not necessarily sold on, because if I look, and I have plenty of examples of, like, you still need infrastructure.
You still do.
So there's still going to be value created at the infrastructure layer, and we can look at, like, the Confluent or HashiCorp and those type, like, even just GitLab, right? Like, infrastructure still is there, and there are companies, gigantic companies, being made on the infrastructure layer. Now, are there a ton more applications? Yeah, probably.
The only thing I will say about that, and I think those are fantastic examples. I was actually at LinkedIn back when the founders of Confluent were still at LinkedIn. So the one thing I will say about that, that's maybe one of those pieces of infrastructure that makes a lot of sense, because that was proven where a bunch of internet scale companies were like, I need a public pub sub system. And Confluent was like, actually, you know what? This is like the best, Kafka is the best pub sub system you can make. And it's a primitive that every internet scale company or any company with a lot of data needs. And it was proven out over many years. Like, every company had figured out their own crappy pub sub system. And suddenly one company was like, we have the best one. Guys, we figured it out over years of building it out. LinkedIn's been using it for years. It's replaced everything we had in the past. And now here's ready to go and consume. But that took many years to hit. Like, no, if Kafka had come out in 2000, companies would have been like, what is this for? It did, or maybe Kafka wouldn't have looked as polished as it looked like now to be easily consumed by every company. That's like the take I have in my head, right? There was no Kafka in 2000, basically.
Yeah, it goes back to really like this idea of course, like even in the data engineering sphere, which I feel is a bit more mature than the MLOps sphere, almost every tool that I see come out is just a new abstraction. It's like, we're going to create a better abstraction layer than the last tool or the other tools out there. And that's really what they're trying to hit on is, hey, how do we create a abstraction layer that is comfortable for data engineers? And it's almost like we are, again, so early in the journey when it comes to using ML and AI, that trying to hit on the right abstraction layer is maybe a little bit preemptive.
Yeah. And maybe if I can add one thing to that, and this might not be super interesting to the audience, I actually worked at Cloudera in like 2014 and then Databricks at 2017. And Obviously, one is like living in the Hadoop ecosystem, right? Back when, and Hadoop solved like an interesting problem, right? Companies had a lot of data and processing it. And then Spark came out, and at Databricks, the reason why it won was it was 10 times better. And there were so many companies that already had Hadoop. And it was like, this is actually the right way to process your data. But if something else came out that was like, and maybe this goes to an interesting point to what you said, which is like every company is trying to make something that's like, you know, some way ergonomically better. If one company came out with a product that was like 10% or 20% better than Spark, it would not get the adoption that Spark had, right? Because Spark was such a big improvement over the previous technology. And it was already being used at so many large companies that it was a no-brainer for more companies to take it on after that. So it was proven out at a lot of companies before Databricks was able to become the behemoth that it is right now.
Yeah, so it's almost like saying that if you're 10% better than Spark, that's not going to be worth the pain of ripping out Spark in your infrastructure.
Yep.
Because 10% is like, ah, I could deal with 10%, whatever.
Yep, especially if it deals with having to work with a vendor that's like a much smaller player, right?
Yeah, because you don't have that assurance that they're going to be around forever. So
that's
okay,
right,
dude. I like this. I'm going to change gears though, because I really want to hear about Codeium, and I really like this idea of like, you built something knowing that you were already in this gigantic scale because you were with ExaFunction, you had scale that you were giving to customers and you were helping people with the serving layer. And then you were like, okay, well, let's just do that, but with our own product now, right?
Yep.
So I'm guessing that, because now give me the, like, fact check me on this, but you're serving a lot of people, like hundreds of thousands of developers.
Yeah.
So yeah, break that down.
Let me go into the story. So we started building Codeium last year. We realized the product needs to be free. We would go bankrupt if we used OpenAI. So we then start saying, hey, we got to like train our own models. We have to train our own models to make this work. So we actually pre-train entire models from scratch to run Codeium for our developers. We train our own models. We evaluate them. We deploy, we A-B test them, all this other stuff. And we learn a ton, by the way. And a lot of the conventional stuff of like prompt engineering, yeah, we had to prompt engineer in interesting ways, and I can go into that. But a lot of it was domain specific, and I can also go into that. Because for our problem, I'll tell you why training our own models provided us a lot of value. For our problem, when you write code, Codeium's one of its main features is autocomplete. And autocomplete is maybe a little bit of a devious term because it sounds like, oh, this is like providing me like a couple characters. We sometimes generate 20, 30 lines of code for the end user.
No way. That's awesome.
And the reality is when we generate code, we need to look at both code before and after, code in different files too. And this doesn't look like the data set of, this doesn't look like any of the tasks that exist right now for these generative models. Generative models, generally speaking, the way it works is like you have some existing text and it just keeps adding onto it. It doesn't, by default, it doesn't know how to apply context from other files. It doesn't know how to fill in code in between your cursor. And so we had to train models explicitly to do these tasks well and to tune them to do well on these tasks. So we had to actually go out and train our own models to actually do this. Some numbers about our scale: we started the year with around 1,000 users, and now we have hundreds of thousands of users using the product. On the VS Code marketplace, if that's any sign, we have close to 400,000 sort of downloads, and then sort of 5-star reviews across all of our users. And in fact, the thing that gives me the most excitement is because we forced ourselves to actually train our models and give the product away for free, it's a bunch of people that have asked us, I don't really understand how this product is free. It is better than Copilot. That is like, you can just look at
you
any
love
review
that.
On
yeah,
it. It's
that's
like, how
great.
Is this product free? And the reality is there's a team on the other end that's like, you know, breaking their back, figuring out how to run this product at massive scale. And just to put in context, we process tens of billions of tokens of code across all of our users. They accept over 100 million lines of code a day across all of our users right now. That's like the level of scale we are talking about. Tens of billions of tokens of code. Think about it as billions of lines of code that we process across all of our users now, right? That's like,
wow.
And we're doing that in ways where we've had to pull out all the stops. We need to do crazy amounts of batching. We take advantage of quantization. We take advantage of model parallelism. We do any trick under the book that we can do, we sort of do. And not only do we do that, which is very interesting, and I'm happy to talk about chat too, we generate more suggestions on a per user basis than products like Copilot do too. There was a recent article from the Wall Street Journal that your users might have read that they're burning a lot of money on a per user basis. Because we've optimized the stack so much and verticalized the product, we have been able to, if you actually notice, there are places where we generate suggestions that Copilot doesn't even generate suggestions. If you're in the middle of a line, Copilot will never generate a suggestion for you. We will generate edits even within a line, which is actually a vast majority of the way people write code. You can imagine, you know, you take a normal software developer lifecycle. Most of the time, they're changing and editing existing code. They're refactoring existing code rather than adding large files of new code, right? And then on top of that, our context, when we apply context throughout your code base, we apply context not even through open files. We apply context through all adjacent, not even adjacent files, but we use embeddings to find any file in your code base to apply context to for the end user.
Yeah. Hey everyone, my name is Aparna, founder of Arise, and the best way to stay up to date with MLOps is by subscribing to this podcast.
That's just for autocomplete. And on top of that, we have a chat system as well that is entirely in-house that also applies context throughout your code base. And I think some of these aspects might be similar, but there are aspects that I can go into that are different across companies, where even right now, a product like Copilot doesn't use context throughout the code base to for either autocomplete or chat. It just uses the open file right now. So we've taken it over the last year. We've moved extremely quickly. We're now one of the world's largest generative AI workloads, which is actually like another crazy stat. I mean, we serve so many users. And our product, the crazy thing is we run a large multi-billion parameter model on every keystroke that a user types. That's like the scale like of what we're talking about. That's basically what autocomplete is. So
wait, so yeah, of course there's all kinds of questions that are coming through my head right now. Like, is it an API? It's a plugin that comes in.
Yeah.
You mentioned, how does that look under the hood? Are you making, or am I making an API call every time I type something? Are you running a model on my machine? Like, what does that even, break it down for me.
Yeah, I can break that down for you. So a couple things that just want to say about how Codeium looks. So Codeium is like a IDE extension. That's the way it presents itself for different users. So you can download an extension on VS Code, IntelliJ, Vim, Eclipse. We support basically every IDE. And part of the reason why we've been able to support every IDE is we actually allow the open source to contribute extensions. And the open source has actually contributed extensions in Emacs, Vim, I believe another one is Xcode, and so on and so forth. We support many different kinds of extensions. And underneath the hood, you're totally right. On every keystroke, we go out to the cloud and we do some processing, right? For a generation, right? On every keystroke that the user types. We don't actually run these models on the user's local machines. And just to give you a sense of the reason why is because at least conventional Macs, there might be the M2 Pro that people run. They can do like somewhere in the 10 to 15 teraflops of compute range. Whereas modern H100s is just an example of just some hardware, can do between 1,000 and 2,000 teraflops of compute. You can just see that there are two orders of magnitude difference between what consumers have access to, and these are like top of the line consumers, versus what exists if you have proper GPUs, and GPUs have much more compute, right, compared to consumers. And most consumers don't run on high quality Macs. Like, most of our users are Windows users that run on top of old laptops that have probably an order of magnitude or maybe 1.5 orders of magnitude less compute than even a Mac when it comes to. So there's no assumption we make on the end user, because that would be unfair to them, right? We would not be able to provide a good enough product to them. We've needed to orchestrate large scale inference to basically run this workload for our users.
Yeah, so tell me then about the scaling that you were doing. Like, how did you go from 1,000 users, like you were saying at the beginning of the year, and then just like ramp? You were up and to the right. I'm sure investors love talking to you, man.
I'm happy to talk a little bit about some of the issues that we had. But let me first talk about the scaling our individual developers. So The way in which we did that was, hey, like, we've built scalable systems. We've already managed 10,000 GPUs in the past. It's not that hard for us to go about managing a lot of GPUs again and scaling our workloads for across many users. That was like we'd built the company around doing that already. So yeah, we had more users, we needed more GPUs. And
so were you already, did you buy a bunch of GPUs or did you just reserve them from Amazon and all that? Like you had GPUs on reserve and so it was a quick and easy shift?
Yeah, so we were able to get reservations to basically do this, and we could plan forward, hey, we're going to have this many, we need this many GPUs to run the workload like this. Obviously, like, maybe one thing, Demetrius, that could be interesting is we actually need significantly less GPUs than probably a company like, than other companies in the space. And, you know, we've needed to, you know, we don't talk too much about our numbers and exactly how we do things internally in terms of optimizing our workloads. But the big thing we provide to enterprises, and we have many large Fortune 500 customers now that are paying us money, they're not just like, I guess, on the individual plan, is we enable companies to self-host the product. So for a lot of companies, you brought up GitLab, right, Demetrius? Like, for a lot of companies, they believe code is their IP. They don't want code leaving the company. And that doesn't matter how, they just don't want it leaking outside of the company, right? And for those companies, they even self-host their code. SEM and GitLab, all those other things are self-hosted for them. And for those companies, we let them actually self-host the product. And you can just imagine, if we had bad infrastructure, if we made the company self-host the product, they would need to buy a lot of hardware. And that would not be fun. They would just say, like, hey, like, you're making me spend a lot on hardware. But instead, these companies don't need to buy a lot of hardware when they self-host Codeium. And for these companies that self-host Codeium, we not only give them the ability to self-host the product, we give them additional benefits of being able to personalize and fine-tune the product on their private data. And we have actually built infrastructure to continuously fine-tune on the same piece of hardware on their code base. And this is another advantage we have because we train our own models from scratch, that we can enable companies to go and do that. And we can optimize that workload and not be like, hey, no, actually ship your entire code base out to OpenAI. If the company doesn't want to do that, we won't make them do that.
And so basically, you meet with a customer, a Fortune 500, they have their GPU capacity, whatever that is, and you give the go, no-go sign on if it's going to work on
their... We don't need
a lot
of GPUs. We ask them to start with, just give us one GPU.
No way. Okay.
Give us one GPU. And in fact, like, we haven't posted a lot of case studies, but we had Dell actually come out with a public case study on their site about how either developers benefited a lot, but they were able to run the workload entirely on-prem in an air-gapped way.
Okay, so that, of course, was one of my other questions. Like, okay, you train these gigantic models. GitHub Copilot is in a bit of hot water right now because people are like, hey, my open source code shouldn't have been trained on that. Did you guys get pulled into that, or did you sidestep that? What's that look like for you?
We've been extremely careful about this, and this was another reason why we decided to go and train our own models. We've done two things. First, we don't train on any non-permissibly licensed code. So that means if your code is GPL, I mean, and I don't know, the audience might know this, there's some forms of code where if you actually copy that code into your code base, you need to make your code base that license too, and that's GPL, right? Which is problematic for commercial code. You don't want to end up like putting some GPL code in your code base and then you need to take your private company's code and make it open and modifiable, right? So we took the steps of early on, don't train on GPL code. And we had a big blog post that we actually came out with that had hundreds of thousands of views on our website about how Copilot actively generates GPL code regardless of all the filters you turn on, right? But we took the point of, we will not train on any GPL code because we're serious about this. We want to be the most secure and compliant way of also consuming this. And large companies should feel good using our product to be, hey, I'm not going to be in any hot water down the line. And this is something which we are also providing end users going forward. We also let them attribute the code. So even for the permissively licensed code, if they want, for some subset of companies, we let them attribute the code also. So we built the software in such a way where we're not going to get into these legal I guess, these legal issues. Because basically, if, first of all, for any permissive, non-permissively licensed code, it's not in the training set, and we can give people the guarantee. And for permissively licensed code, we can give them attribution guarantees if they really want.
So I like to say that I only know two types of licenses out there. One is the kind that Amazon can steal and make their own, and the other is the kind that they can't. So I'm guessing you're talking about the kind that Amazon can steal?
So that is a little bit different. So, okay, companies like MongoDB and maybe Elastic didn't do this, and that's why they're hurting a little bit. MongoDB did was early on, they said, so that Amazon cannot just build our product. And then on top of that, just, you know, kind of sell it because they have much more distribution.
Charge whatever they want. Yep.
We are going to make it so that our product has a commercial license. But if you want to sell the product, I don't believe you can be anyone but Mongo. The MongoDB Corporation, which is a little bit different. The license we're talking about with GPL, that's a non-permissively licensed license, is the thing that's licensing Linux, for instance. Linux is free and open software, but if you copy pieces of Linux and you put it in your source code, then your source code necessarily needs that license and needs to be free and open software, which is problematic for large companies. Imagine telling, I'm going to name a company, imagine telling Shopify, hey, you use GPL code, make your entire code base free and open now. They're not going to be too happy about that.
That's not going to fly at all, man.
Yeah.
That is wild. So then I would love to hear about like some of the basic challenges that you've had. I mean, it seems like scaling, because of the optimization, you were able to kind of sidestep that pain and all of the work that you had done in your past lives. But I imagine there's a ton of other pains that you had.
I could go on for hours. I think the problems were actually very domain specific. How do we build the best code product for an individual and an enterprise is what I think about nonstop.
Sure.
And we needed to build large scale evaluation systems to actually even just validate, hey, is my model better at applying context? Is my model better at completing code? And we've built crazy, and Demetrius, this is where it gets to the internal systems that we've had to build because we are a code-based product. We actually have evaluations that require us to take a bunch of open source repositories, run the unit test in the code base, right? Find functions that cause these unit tests to pass, delete a bunch of the code, and then see if our models, with the context of the remaining part of the code base, make the unit test pass. That's the beautiful thing about code. You can actually execute it and see if the code is correct. Because in other spaces, maybe you do need to validate that it's word for word the same, but we don't really care if the code is word for word the same. We care if the functionality is correct, right? So that has allowed us, this large-scale evaluation has allowed us to check, A, is our model better at applying context? Are we getting context from the right data sources? Are we actually, is our model, the base model, is that an improvement on top of the previous base model at generating code? And there are so many tunables that we get access to, once again, by verticalizing. Right? By us having so tight access to the model, so much tight access to the data, there's so much value we get from that. And that has become an awesome signal. That evaluation I told you has become an awesome signal before we deploy a new batch of software. And then on top of that, when we deploy a new batch of software, we can, in the wild, we have so many completions that we have a day. We have tens of millions of sort of inferences we run a day. We are able to see, is the model getting better in the wild too? Is there a discrepancy between our eval and what we have in the wild? And then on the enterprise side, where we have very little visibility and access to data when we deploy our models, is the end user with fine-tuning on their private code, which is something that only we offer, right? And personalization with their internal SEM, whether it be their code libs in GitLab, Bitbucket, is their product actually getting better? Those are also things we check, and we check in eval offline as well. So there are so many things that we've needed to solve, by the way, that are outside of just scaling the product that are hard, right? And they're unique to us. Like if you talk to another generative AI company that's outside of the code space, they're not going to tell you any of these things are that exciting. All of these things are specific to our company, basically.
Of course, it reminds me of we just did an evaluation survey about a month ago. And we asked people in the MLOps community, how they're doing evaluation and all that. And it's very much like what you're saying. What are they evaluating is a huge question, because as you mentioned, evaluating code is one thing. Evaluating if a poem works or doesn't work is another thing. But code, you have this nice little, it's almost a hack or a cheat code that you get to say it's going to pass unit tests or it's not going to. It's very black and white. And so because of that, it makes it so that you can really build out, I imagine, very robust evaluation frameworks.
Yeah, of course. 100%.
Yeah. And also going back to, you mentioned Midjourney before and all the evaluation that they're doing and how they're evaluating what photo is better than another. And they're keeping us in Discord. Those guys. Go ahead. I thought you were about to say something.
I was just about to say that is exactly right. I think for us, I would say our product is significantly kind of further ahead in terms of what the users have than what a product like Copilot has. But if I was to talk about one thing, I don't want to spend the time bashing a product because it doesn't make sense for us to. Yeah, I think Copilot was a fantastic product. That's like the thing that got us into this space. I think the one interesting thing that you said that was very telling was the requirements for writing a poem are very different than the requirements for generating code, right? They look very different. And there was a feature that Copilot came out with a long time ago. They had this announcement in March about this feature that they had called Copilot X. I still don't know what exactly Copilot X is, but they did a marketing campaign for
it. Yeah, it's huge. It was like, this is the future of software engineering.
I don't know what has really changed since then, but maybe I'm missing out. Copilot had a feature called Copilot for PRs that was going to say, hey, we are going to generate a PR summary. Okay?
Yeah.
And we were early adopters of that. We were like, hey, like maybe they figured out something very interesting. Like, let's try it out. Like, we're always excited to try new technology. And basically, you can think about the PR process. There are three things you can do. You can either write the PR, you can review the PR, or you can summarize the PR, right? There are only three really things you can do. And when they wrote the PR summary, we noticed that the PR summary was most of the time like either wrong, it missed out things in the PR. And then at that point, I ended up reading the PRs anyway, but the PR summary had one really good thing in it, which was a poem. And it was this short haiku that sort of summarized the PR. It was like three sentences and it was kind of cute. But it went to show to me that the bar required to make tasks, to actually optimize a task, isn't just make a user feel good. It's like, if you make a PR summary and it's wrong, you will erode user trust in the product. And by the way, that is why we are so hawkish when it comes to like our performance of our product. How well are people using the chat product? How well are people using the autocomplete product? Are we generating more and more lines of code for people? Because we look at the metrics with a fine-tooth comb.
Yeah.
We constantly are like, oh, are users really enjoying the product? Like, can we find out if we ship this out, are users going to accept more code? And how do we give them more value is all I think about. It's not the point of like, hey, can I generate them a cute poem and you know, build this hackathon feature. There's so many easy Twitter demos. I'm not saying the Twitter demos are easy, but there are so many things we could ship that are like easy eye attention grabbers. But unless there's recurring usage, we're not going to go and do it, basically.
So are those the main metrics that you're looking at and you're focusing on? Like how much code was accepted? How long are people using this or what?
Yeah, like how much time are people spending and getting value from our tool? Right. And we look at it from the holistic software development lifecycle. There's like chat is now a paradigm people do. People do some work in the terminal to debug stuff. People do a lot of work in the IDE to read and understand code. And then people do work in the SCM like GitLab to generate PR summaries, to review code. And we're looking for ways in which we as a company can actually improve the lifecycle for the end developer. Right. How do we actually improve that? And that may mean we're not doing the entire thing end-to-end. We are not at the stage where developers are useless now. We cannot go and generate a PR all in one shot. Like no company can go and do that. So what we should be doing is trying to be the best aid to reduce the amount of work that the developer does and make it as easy as possible for them to do their underlying task. And that might mean just getting rid of the boilerplate tasks. But it may mean, hey, we're not at the point where we can generate accurate PR summaries. And that's fine. ultimately, we're only going to deliver a product if developers will reliably use the product with time.
So you mentioned before how basically with ExaFunction, you were 1 point on a 6 or 7 point step in putting machine learning AI into production. Now you've kind of switched, and now you are a tool that is using all of the different points, or at least you have to get all of these different points correct. Are you using any pointed solutions, or is everything in-house? Like, have you gone out onto the market and said, what's out there for the monitoring tool? Let me go see. What's out there for a serving tool, et cetera, et cetera?
So I think maybe one thing I will say is like, yeah, we're not going to re-implement things like monitoring with Prometheus and Grafana. These are systems that we use. And for feature flagging, we're not going to go and like build our own in-house feature flagging system, right? If we want to like ship changes very quickly. But when it comes to the LLM space, we also need to self-host the product for our end user. So it doesn't make sense for us to go out and rely on a SaaS solution if we can build a tightly integrated verticalized product. Because if we do, like for instance, maybe I'll give you an example. We actually run our own large vector databases ourselves. And if we used a system like Pinecone, which I'm sure Pinecone is a great system, and then we wanted to go to a company that needs to self-host, we can't just be like, hey guys, create a Pinecone contract with us. Also, we have to be like, no, like we're going to provide you the solution. And also on top of that, our vector stores are at a scale right now where we would be spending a tremendous amount of money if we wanted to use Pinecone. So we, out of necessity, figured out how to build the product ourselves, like across each of our users. And, you know, probably as, you know, maybe 1 million vectors or maybe tens of thousands of vectors to give us. So we're talking about, you know, maybe billions of vectors that we need to collect. Right, maybe tens of billions of vectors we need to collect. So I think for us right now, we are focused on, for the things that require the core product to work, we have not gone out and got a lot of point solutions. Like, I don't know what point solution we would buy for prompt engineering when we actually fine-tune our own models. We know our data sources that we need to use. We have tight integrations of, is the product getting better or worse with time? Obviously, we would need to measure these things ourselves. We can't outsource that to someone else. So it's actually strange. We're not really purchasing anything externally.
So then, basically it goes back to that point you were making before where you were saying how because we are still so early, it doesn't make sense to buy something on the market. And it feels like you are just like a microcosm of what you were talking about before, that is this macrocosm of, you're not going and getting, or AWS and Google didn't create, or they didn't go on to the market and figure out how to create AWS, or buy AWS, I should say, when they were scaling and they were building Amazon, because it was too early.
And we are being a little pragmatic here. Like, we're not re-implementing and self-hosting like crazy databases for our own internal product, although we do need to self-host them for end users. And this is the same. Actually, one very interesting story about Amazon was Amazon early days ran a lot of their database transactions off of Oracle. Their Oracle bill ran crazy high. And then at some point, they were like, hey, we got to have an in-house team to build our own database. Granted, we don't want to get there. I think database software is the hardest software out there. We never want to go and build a database. Like, we will, for anything where we can buy or use something off the shelf, we will use things off the shelf if possible. But we tend to like open source solutions that we can self-host if possible too, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I heard a podcast where they were talking about Amazon was still using Oracle until like 2018.
I'm sure.
And that was the last Oracle server got shut down in 2018 and they had like a party. But the thing that I find fascinating is this idea of, you understand, all right, Prometheus, or if you're trying to use feature flags, then you're going to go out there and you're going to buy some SaaS. But when it comes to the ML AI lifecycle, you're not as bullish on going out there and buying something. You would rather create it in-house. And really, that just shows to me like exactly what you were talking about before, right? How right now, it feels too early. You are so custom, and everything that's out on the market doesn't really address the needs that you have gone in. You've ran so fast in one direction for the last whatever year and a half, that there's not tools out there that are sufficiently advanced as you would like them to be. And so maybe it just needs time to catch up. And then in a few years, you're going to be like, okay, cool. We don't need to do this anymore because there's enough out there that we can just offload it.
Yeah. And the weird thing is I also feel, putting my startup hat on, I don't know if we're like the best customers. Like, let's suppose someone helps us with code evaluations. They're not going to be able to take that and sell it to Midjourney or sell that to Character AI, right? So, I mean, you get what I'm saying? So it's I think it's people need to figure out what the common piece of infrastructure is that is worth selling. And if there's a whole, I think there's 100 companies now selling like Llama 2 APIs, right? Potentially, right? But like ultimately, I don't know, like, is this a race to everyone getting to the reservation cost of a GPU? Like, is that what's going to happen in a year? Like, everyone's running the same model. Why is this not going to like completely, why is the alpha not going to completely disappear from this product? The reason why we're not just doing that is we have our own models. We actually have our own ways of potentially quantizing the models, but that's very specific to our workloads. And we've tuned the training pipeline even for the quantization step for our own workload. So we can't use something completely off the shelf. And then if we did, yeah, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of providers that are going to just do Llama 2, but I don't know why we'd pick one over the other right now. Maybe at some point we would pick one. I will say, I think we probably have a better understanding of this than most companies, just because we've been running these models longer than some of these generative AI companies. Some of these infra companies have been running infra models for Llama 2 and stuff, but yeah.
Yeah, and it very much is like you are focused very, very sharply on one specific problem, which is this coding problem, as opposed to, hey, we're training this big ass model, aka GPT-4, and one of the things it does is coding. Or we have Llama, and even though we didn't really do much training data with coding, we're gonna fine tune it and call it Code Llama, and it's gonna be pretty good, you know? So I do see the value in you just saying, like, we want to be the best at this coding, and we are going to focus 100% on it and optimize every area that we can for it.
That's right. Ultimately, for us, the only thing that matters is we have an application that our users love and want to use every day. That's like all that matters to us. And yeah, like if the reality is we could run some logistic regression in the background that is not a complex model, we'd do that in a heartbeat. Unfortunately, that doesn't cut it. Like, I don't think if we ran logistic regression on the user's machine, they would have a great product. You actually brought up before the interview something about a company called Kite, right? You brought up this is a company that did autocomplete that went bankrupt. Or maybe not bankrupt, but dissolved. I think it was a great product. I think the only problem was LLMs are what have made these code assistants capable now. And they existed pre-LLMs existing. And I think if you didn't make the jump, you were not going to meet your users where they wanted the product. And that was what I believe happened. And for us, we just want to build the best product that our users love. And they got to be... I'm excited when our users are like, how is this thing free? That's what I'm always excited by.
Yeah, that's got to be the best compliment. That is so cool. I mean, I've heard it like once or twice with somebody just being like, wow, these podcasts, all the community, I can't believe you don't charge for that. And I'm like, how would I charge for what we're doing here in the community? You know, like that, if anything, we can get sponsors and we can charge them, but like to the end user, no. And so the one thing that I wonder about, because I've been talking with people in the LLM space for, I don't know, the last 6-8 months, and there is ideas of like new software architectures that are coming up, right? And I think one thing that you mentioned that would be cool to talk about is how you basically are future-proofing the work that you're doing at Codeium. And I was just talking to my friend Rohit about this, and he was saying, like, you know, a lot of the times we think about wanting to be backwards compatible, but he's trying to like bring this idea of like, how can we be forward compatible, so that if you are someone who is thinking about bringing AI into your company, you don't have this FOMO of like, oh, well, in 6 months, the world's going to completely change. And then everything that this big project that took me 6 months to implement, the day that it goes out, it's already going to be obsolete. And so when you think about things like that, like, how do you make sure to cover your back?
Yeah, I think it's maybe two things. So in the past, I worked in the autonomous vehicle space where we were, at least when I was there, we were never exactly there yet. Like, the tech was always just right around the corner. And the thing I love to tell people, which is very, very interesting, is there are secular trends that you can never beat, okay? And when I started working at Neuro, like, the GPUs that people had access to and that we were running in the cars had between 10 and 20 teraflops. And now consumer-grade GPUs have hundreds of teraflops, right? There's a 50x increase in GPU capacity on a per-GPU basis that has happened over the last 6 years, right? Which is crazy, by the way. That's just nuts.
Yeah.
And these are increases that have enabled brand new models that were never possible to run 6 years ago from now being able to run now. So all that goes to show is that this space is very exciting. There will be crazy things that are capable of being run in 4 years that we are not going to be able to anticipate today. And don't design systems today that require a Herculean amount of engineering to make the ML models of today workable. So the end takeaway is don't build elaborate UIs and all this other stuff to make models today kind of work well. Because the problem is what's going to happen is a couple years from now, the model will get better and a lot of the things that you implemented are not going to be nearly as useful. They're not going to be as pragmatic. So build for technology that works today. That's like the biggest thing that I always think of. And when you build for technology that works today, make sure that the technology that you build is a primitive that can later compound. And by that, I mean, you know, there are many things that we can sort of do when as a startup, we can implement features here, features there. And every feature is some work from our engineering team, right? But if that feature is something that is evergreen, right? If we figure out ways in which our model is much better at applying context and we are much better at fine-tuning, as we improve the base model, as we improve more context sources, as we improve all these other things, it's going to be a rising tide lifts all boats. It will improve all facets of our system. So that's an awesome kind of feature to invest in as a company, because the technology works today. It's something that if I improve the surrounding pieces, it'll continue to compound on itself, right? But on the other hand, if all I'm doing is I'm adding UIs here and there, those are things that I believe the competition can copy very quickly, right? Which is not good for a startup like us. But B, also, that is not something where, like, as the models get better, that's like gonna, you know, that's gonna improve my product. I don't know if that helped there.
Yeah. My main takeaway from what you just said is the rate of change is so fast that all this stuff that you think super advanced and it gets you like a point or a percent better today, but it takes you so much effort and it's so hard to do. In 2-3 years, it's going to be laughable how small of a change that is compared to just how everything has moved, you know, 50, 200% more in the direction that you were trying to go today. And you didn't need to put that Herculean effort into it.
Yeah. Or most of the time, I think what happens is you end up putting in the Herculean effort and it really still didn't get there, but you just put it out there anyways.
That's speaking, like, from wisdom, isn't it? You've had...
Yeah,
that,
and that's
gone
the
down
worst.
That path enough. Yeah, yeah, totally.
No, there's a lot of battle scars here for sure.
Yeah, dude. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I really appreciate you coming on here and talking with me. I love everything about what you're doing, and I would encourage anyone who is not trying Codeium to go and give it a play. It seems like me and my horrible coding skills could even become an incredible coder. I might start shipping stuff over the weekend now that I'm going to go have a play with it.
I love it.
Watch out, world. Here we go. It's so cool, man. So thank you, Varun. And we'll end it there, man.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for having me.
Hey, this is Mike Dalbasso, co-founder and CEO of Tekton. MLOps community is the best way to stay in the loop on the latest MLOps news and best practices. It's also a great way to connect with experts and get support from an amazingly helpful community. Subscribe and stay in the loop.